Good morning. It's 11 minutes before the hour on Wednesday, December 28th, 2011. I'm Jeff Seifert for Raven News. At its regular meeting last night, the Sitka Assembly added $1.1 million to a contract with an engineering firm working on the Blue Lake Dam. But city officials say the costs were expected and that the overall project is still under budget. City Utility Director Christopher Bruton says the extra money for Vancouver-based Hatch Acres is needed to cover additional design work on the dam. But he also says the company admitted to some inefficiencies on its side and knocked about $500,000 off the bill as a result. The total Hatch contract is nearly $9 million. Even though officials say the extra charges were expected, they still expressed some displeasure with Hatch Acres. Dean Orbison with the city's electric department told the assembly that Hatch didn't meet the deadlines during the recent part of the project.
They were slow in getting things done, and they didn't do quite as well as I would have liked. And as you recall, when we signed the professional services agreement with Hatch, we said we're breaking this project into four parts.
Orbison says the fourth part of the project, the construction management, will be put back out for bid instead of given to Hatch, as was originally hoped. The company will still get about $800,000 to participate in construction engineering. Orbison says the city is putting forth the fourth part of the project back out for bid because missing deadlines during the construction phase could cause big problems.
If we had delays and difficulty getting things done during construction, you've got a contractor standing on the job site wanting to be paid. You can't wait around because someone didn't get around to it. And so I don't want to do that.
The city's electric department also led off last night's meeting by telling the assembly about a new EPA regulation it hopes will be overturned. Sitka, like a lot of Alaska communities, uses massive diesel generators to help produce electricity. New rules from the Environmental Protection Agency will require additional equipment and testing to monitor the output of those generators. The federal government wants the work done by May of 2013. But in a memo to the Sitka Assembly, Utility Director Christopher Bruton calls the regulation, quote, overkill, unquote. He says it would require nearly $800,000 of new equipment, plus work and testing that would bring the cost to nearly $1 million. Bruton says the regulation makes allowances for rural areas, but it considers Sitka to be urban, along with Angoon, Tanaki, Cake, Hoonah, and Hollis. Bruton called the new regulation a good news, bad news story, and said the good news is that Alaska's congressional delegation is seeking an exemption to the rule. Any study examining Sitka's distinctiveness absolutely must include a fisherman. Fishing has been a mainstay of civilization on Baranof Island, literally since the dawn of civilization. But not all fishermen are men. In part four of her five-part series of Sitka profiles, reporter Diana Saverin meets Linda Benkin, who is a fisherman, resource advocate, policy planner, and mom.
Like many in Sitka, Linda Benkin finds herself more on her boat than on land during fishing season. She's a fisherman, among other things. She came here for the first time when she was in college, and she said she fell in love on sight. Since then, she has been committed to this town and the lifestyle it offers.
Let's see. I guess I first came up to earn money for college and took the ferry up and knew by the time I got off the ferry I wanted to live here. Just loved it. Loved the place and loved the whole fishing community and working on the ocean and the people, that sort of way of life. I just fell in love with that.
Moving to Sitka to fish wasn't always the plan, though. She was thinking of being a writer while in college at Dartmouth. But Sitka offered something she couldn't refuse.
You know, I was going to college and coming up here and fishing in the summers. I almost dropped out of college to stay here, but I got talked out of that. Where I grew up was more suburbs and not, we had really neighbors we were close to, but there wasn't a very strong sense of community. And so the tightness of the fishing community, people are very independent, but when something goes wrong, they're all there for each other and they help each other with projects and whatever. And I just really liked that.
Linda stayed in college, eventually earning a master's from Yale Forestry School. From there, she moved into resource policy, where she's been ever since. Linda has run ALFA, the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, for 20 years. And she served three terms on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Linda seemed to pick the toughest battles. The Southeast Trawl Ban created one of the largest areas without trawlers at the time, and she also helped craft the IFQ management system for the bottom fisheries. This work didn't always make her popular, but it did preserve a way of life for many fishermen.
The small boats are usually run by families who live in the coastal communities, and community fishermen are, for one, I think it's a really important way of life. It's people who are still really tied to the ocean and so have a connection to wild places that's really different from the way most people live anymore. They also are generally real advocates for healthy, sustainable oceans and fisheries because they want to have something to hand on to their children.
Fishing is grueling work. So is advocacy, even though it doesn't leave evidence on her calloused hands. There's always a new issue. Declining quota, bycatch, reconciling differences with the charter sector, and even sperm whales, who have figured out that cod and halibut caught on longlines make a tasty treat. Linda thinks about a quieter life, but so far doesn't have an exit strategy.
I tried to quit a couple times, but they won't let me. There's never really been enough money to pay much of a salary, so it's more doing it because it's stuff I really care about. And, you know, so it's hard to replace someone who'll work really hard for almost no money. I think our association's been really effective. When you're effective, people don't want you to quit.
And Linda has a third full-time job. She's the mother of two boys, Halen and Rio, who are 7 and 9. As she works to preserve the lifestyle of small family fishermen on a larger scale, she's adapting a lifestyle of her own to make her many jobs work in synergy.
The way the quota share program's written, you have to be there when your quota's being caught. I had to go fishing, and they were nursing, each of them, sequentially, so they had to go along. And I fished one 4 or 5 day halibut trip when Halen was a year and a half and I was pregnant. I think I was 8 months, and that one about killed me. I just remember being exhausted. The first time around being pregnant, I was just deathly seasick, so that didn't work. So I quit crewing and was just fishing my own boat for the rest of the time I was pregnant, but that was enough. I wouldn't recommend it. And I remember thinking, what did I ever think was hard about fishing before I had kids? You know, it just seems like it would be so easy. It is. It's a lot easier now.
In Sitka, I'm Diana Savran.
Diana Savran is a Kingsley Trust Fellow from Yale University. She visited Sitka last summer to interview residents who had participated in a study of the community's distinctiveness. The study, by researcher Gary Holthaus, is called Up for Discussion, What Makes a Sustainable Community? It was published by the Island Institute with support from the Alaska Humanities Forum. Part 5 of Savarin's series is not a profile of a person, but of a community within a community, the Sitka Fine Arts Camp. We'll have that story for you next week. A Ketchikan mill is slated to begin producing wood pellets this winter. As Deanna Garrison reports, Tongass Forest Enterprises is hoping to capitalize on a recent surge in interest in processed wood heating products in southeast Alaska.
This is a very basic assembly line for pellets. This is a 1 ton an hour press. It means it, at its optimal production rate, it will produce 1 ton of pellets an hour.
That's Forest Enterprises owner Larry Jackson standing in front of what will soon be Ketchikan's first wood pellet mill. The approximately $350,000 pellet operation is located in a 40,000-square-foot former Ketchikan pulp mill warehouse in Ward Cove. The warehouse also houses Jackson's existing business, which for the past 8 years has produced custom wood products ranging from cabins and greenhouses to survey stakes and kitchen cabinets. That business also produces mountains of wood byproduct that Jackson plans to use to create wood pellets.
We're basically doing two things. We're getting rid of a byproduct that would have cost us money to get rid of, generating some revenue, and we're taking a traditional oil-based boiler and replacing that with woody biomass or pellet boilers, and you're getting the added benefit of not having that carbon or that oil being consumed. And it's going to save the end user money because it's going to be cheaper. It already is cheaper to buy the pellets.
A ton of pellets provides the same amount of heat as 120 gallons of heating oil. The cost of a ton of pellets runs between $250 and $300, compared to nearly $500 for 120 gallons of oil in Ketchikan. Jackson is expanding his wood products business at a time when Southeast Alaska's timber industry is on a downhill slide. Most of the large players in the industry have shut down, and the remaining mills say they are on the brink of closure due to a lack of timber supply. Jackson says he has enough timber to keep his wood products company going.
The issue isn't so much the supply, it's whether the supply is economical enough, because pellets are really a product that is best suited for a byproduct, meaning it comes off of a waste stream from a traditional manufacturing line. So the idea of harvesting a log to make into pellets or whatever, it just probably is not ever going to be economical.
Jackson is hoping the pellet mill will help promote future growth in wood manufacturing within the region.
Creating a demand for byproduct from our mill and other mills, if they chose to get into business, you're going to see that helps the manufacturing costs. So maybe we can now bring in other people to do more manufacturing. So that part's good.
The federal government has begun converting its buildings to biomass heat. Ketchikan officials have also taken note as the community's availability of cheap hydroelectric power is expected to max out in the near future. The city of Ketchikan is putting a wood pellet boiler in its new library, currently under construction. Jackson says his pellet plant will help Ketchikan become more energy independent. Jackson is currently supplying the federal building in downtown Ketchikan and Southeast Alaska Discovery Center with pellets he shipped in from other suppliers while he works to get his pellet plant up and running. He says he plans to only provide bulk sales for the first year. After that, he wants to begin bagging pellets to be sold in area stores. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's it for Raven News for this hour. You're listening to KCAW Sitka. It's 1 minute past the hour. Good morning.